I'm Marty Moscow, and welcome to Radio Times. Almost 20 years ago, the Institute of Medicine published their groundbreaking report, Unequal Treatment, revealing that racial and ethnic minorities in this country were more likely to receive lower quality care than whites. Even when taking into consideration income and neighborhood and health insurance, outcomes for African Americans were worse than whites. That was 2002. And while our healthcare system is very different today, and there has been some progress addressing these racial disparities in medical care, problems still exist. How much are because of access and lack of insurance? How much are due to chronic health risks more likely to affect African Americans? How much is because of implicit or even explicit bias? How much involves mistrust of the healthcare system? We asked three Philadelphia-based physicians to be our guests to talk about their experiences as Black medical professionals and the work that they are doing to close the health and healthcare gap. Let me introduce the three of them to you. Dr. Tiffany Johnson is a faculty member at Policy Lab at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. She's an assistant professor of pediatrics in the Division of Emergency Medicine at CHOP and at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. She's a member of CHOP's Center for Perinatal and Pediatric Health Disparities Research. And Dr. Tiffany Johnson, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Also with us is Dr. Shanae Jeffers. She's an obstetrics and gynecology resident at Thomas Jefferson University Hospital and the Philadelphia site director of Daughters of the Diaspora. That's a nonprofit that teaches self-esteem and reproductive health to adolescent young women throughout the African diaspora. Dr. Shanae Jeffers, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning. It's an honor. Thank you.
It's great to have you with us. And rounding out our trio of guests is Dr. Ted Corbin. He's a professor in the Department of Emergency Medicine at Drexel University College of Medicine and the medical director of the Healing Hurt People Program. That's an emergency department-based trauma-informed intervention strategy that identifies victims of intentional injury. Dr. Ted Corbin, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times. Nice to have all three of you with us.
Thank you so much, Mary.
You're very welcome. Let me begin. I want our listeners to know a little bit about you before we talk about all these very serious and important issues, but let me start with you, Dr. Johnson. Tell us how you got into, I guess, emergency medicine, but also pediatrics, your interest.
Well, I first started off in pediatric residency training, and when I went into medical school, I really went in with an open mind to try to fully explore all of the potential specialties, and I really connected with pediatrics. I love that children are a little bit more of a vulnerable population, but what I really love about kids is that they're so resilient. So kids come in broken, and you can actually fix them, and I really like that, as opposed to sometimes with the adult populations, they come in broken and leave slightly less broken. So I really enjoy connecting with the pediatric patients, and I think I'm still a little bit of a kid at heart, so I also enjoy that part of the pediatric population. Ultimately, I went into emergency medicine because I wanted to go into medicine to be able to advocate for underrepresented and underserved populations through my clinical practice, advocacy, and research. And emergency medicine provides a really unique opportunity for me to be able to do that because in the ER, we see every patient that comes through the door, regardless of how much money they make, regardless of whether they have insurance, regardless of what their immigration status is. And I really like that honor of being able to provide the best quality care to everyone that comes to my door, regardless of what their background is.
I mean, it seems like a nice joining of two passions for you.
Absolutely.
Dr. Jeffers, tell us, I was reading a little bit about you, and I read that when you were a little girl, you wanted to be not just a doctor, but an OBGYN.
Yes. That is exactly correct. I actually don't have any other memories of wanting to do any other job beside be a baby doctor, which is what I called it then. And it's kind of been a self-fulfilling prophecy, like working backwards. I've wanted to do this since a child. And by the time, you know, I started taking more classes about the medical field, it just really, I realized that, you know, from a scientific way, I really was interested in embryology. I was interested in pregnancy still. It still is a miracle to me. And being a part of that process is amazing. And I think as I got older and kind of just learned more about the world, I understood the magnitude of protecting women's health and being an advocate for women's health. And it's just been better and better.
So why, as a little girl, did you want to be a baby doctor? I mean, of all the things.
I really don't know. My mom is a nurse, and I know that that had a lot of influence in terms of, you know, my attraction to the medical field. But, you know, even as an 8-year-old, I used to watch, like, on other channels, like, very graphic shows about labor and delivery, about the emergency room. I don't know. I've just always been drawn to it.
How about for you, Dr. Corbin?
Sure. I would say that first, it's really a privilege to be a physician and to take care of people. And I went into emergency medicine specifically because it is the one place everyone is entitled to equitable care. And it's the safety net of the community, and we are there to provide appropriate, equitable, and great care for our patients.
And that's something that you wanted to do? I mean, even as a young man?
I would say that I was, again, unfortunately, there weren't a lot of black male doctors in the community where I grew up. And so not being able to see one, you really can't imagine to be one. So I think my journey was, my parents were big proponents of education, and they encouraged me to go as far as I could. Initially, I thought I wanted to be a scientist, but then as I grew into my own, I would say I became much more interested in caring for people.
And you care largely with young men, and we'll be talking more about the Healing Hurt program, really at that moment of crisis for a young person.
Absolutely.
And I do want to talk about some of these things about explicit, implicit bias and all these disparities, but I wonder too, and I'll put this to you, Dr. Johnson, whether you've had to deal with that as a physician yourself. And I'm thinking of someone thinking, well, you're not a doctor, you're the nurse. Have you had to deal with things like that?
I'm pretty sure everyone who's sitting around this table,
I'm putting it out there kind of knowing what the answer
experience.
Is, but go ahead. I appreciate that.
So I have certainly had that experience, and I actually recently wanted to give a little bit more of a voice to people who have that experience. So as a researcher, I conducted a qualitative study with some of my colleagues in pediatric emergency medicine at the top NIH-funded and top volume pediatric emergency departments across the country. And what we found with in the themes with the underrepresented women who are underrepresented in medicine, so African-American and Latino women, one of the common themes was experiences of microaggressions, as well as what I refer to as hashtag what a doctor looks like.
Right.
And so when you walk into a room, even if you're wearing a white coat and your stethoscope, the interesting thing is that the theme among the white women was, oh, you must be the nurse. But what I have gotten myself and many of my colleagues is, oh, you must be here to transport us to radiology.
Oh,
you must be here to change the trash. So while I think there are definitely some gender issues where women are mistaken as nurses, but when you add that intersectionality of race and gender, it's, you know, you can't even actually be a healthcare professional. You must be a janitor or transport tech.
In the hierarchy, even lower, you are nodding your head, Dr. Jeffers.
Yes. Sometimes I get the social worker as well. But
what do you say? I mean, if someone sort of makes that assumption or says something that implies or reveals that they don't think you're a doctor.
I always introduce myself as Dr. Jeffers, and I know that that's a style thing. There are some attendings who, you know, say their first name. But I think because I'm so cognizant of not only being a black woman, but also how young I look, which I always hear about as well, it is important to me that I introduce myself as Dr. Jeffers. And, you know, if I develop a relationship with a patient by the end and they ask my name again, I'll say, you know, my name is Dr. Shanae Jeffers. But, I think it's important for me to remain firm in that for that reason.
And you, Dr. Corbin, had mentioned the fact that growing up, there were no black doctors that you knew of or were in your neighborhood or treated you. Have you had to deal with similar experiences where people made the assumption that you were not a doctor?
It happens all too frequent. And very similar to Dr. Johnson and Dr. Jeffers is the assumption of being someone else, despite even saying, hi, I'm Dr. Corbin. I'm going to be taking care of you today. So it is very prevalent, very common, and it's unfortunate. Yeah. But it's a matter of just, I often just politely reintroduce to let them know that I'm going to be taking care of them.
You're the doctor in the room. But it does, and you mentioned this earlier, and I was reading about the fact that there is I guess, a shortage of black doctors, black male doctors as well. Obviously, the more interactions people have, the more they will understand and not make these assumptions. Can you speak to that?
Sure. And what I think we've seen over the course of the years, there has been a bump in African-Americans in medical school. The interesting part of that, it's great in that that's largely due to African-American women. Black women are more. We're seeing a decline in African-American men specifically. Yeah. And that's a challenge.
Yeah, why is that, do you think?
It is undoubtedly issues of race, issues of the cost of medical education, issues of socioeconomic status. There's a myriad of things, and it might not necessarily be one of those. It could be all three of those things, and then many more things added on to it. But it is a challenge because I think it's very hard for young men to see someone as a physician that they could be.
Sure.
And so not seeing it, you can't imagine doing it.
But that's some of the power of
and this
is Dr.
Johnson.
Being,
yeah, go ahead.
Some of the power of us being in our role is one of the things that I enjoy the most is when I am interacting with patients and I may be the first African-American doctor that they've seen. And so it is truly a privilege to not only be able to provide medical care for them, but to also provide that model like, yes, I'm a doctor. I have an afro. I'm a black woman. And you can be a doctor, too.
There was another study I was reading about that that white doctors had a maybe fraught, I'm not sure, but sort of an uncomfortable relationship with their black patients. Is that something you've looked at, Dr. Johnson?
Well, I think it's going to be different for every patient. So there is research that shows that patients, when they have the option, they prefer to have concordance in their relationship, meaning that African-Americans would have a preference for having African-American doctors. But in general, you know, especially in pediatrics, for example, one of the things that's unique about pediatrics, especially in primary care, is that you have a relationship where you have multiple visits with your medical doctor. So kids have to come in for their newborn visit, a 2-month visit, 4, 6, 9, 12 months, and you develop relationships with your doctors over time. And so I've done some research looking at trust within the healthcare system to look at parents of younger children to look at that relationship around kind of trust in your healthcare provider and trust in the healthcare system. And what we imagined that we were going to find based on some of the studies in adult populations was that the African-American parents would have a lot less more distrust for their providers. But what we actually found was that particularly when it comes to your pediatrician, there was actually a lot of trust in those relationships.
Interesting.
So even if patients have a preference for a provider that looks like them, there is still an opportunity for you to establish those rapports and to establish that trust over time. And I think that that is a privilege for us when we're having these frequent interactions with our patients. And also for my colleagues, that you don't have to look like your patients to be able to connect with them and to be able to provide high quality care for them, and the patients feel that as well. So they just want a doctor who cares about their kids.
Let's take that short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Dr. Tiffany Johnson. We also have with us in our Philadelphia studio here Dr. Shanae Jeffers and Dr. Theodore Ted Corbin. All three of them doctors working here in the Philadelphia area. We're talking about racial disparities in our healthcare system and what to do about it. Stay with us. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane talking with our guests today. They are all black medical professionals here in Philadelphia. The work that they are doing to close the health and healthcare gap when it comes to racial disparities. And let me do another official reintroduction. They all have very long introductions, but I'm going to do them anyway. Dr. Tiffany Johnson, faculty member at Policy Lab at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, assistant professor of pediatrics in the Division of Emergency Medicine at CHOP. And a member of the of CHOP Center for Perinatal and Pediatric Health Disparities Research, Dr. Shanae Jeffers, obstetrics and gynecology resident at Thomas Jefferson University Hospital, also site director of Daughters of the Diaspora, that's a nonprofit teaching self-esteem and reproductive health to adolescent young women throughout the African diaspora. And Dr. Ted Corbin is a professor in the Department of Emergency Medicine at Drexel University's College of Medicine, also director of a program here in Philadelphia called Healing Hurt people. You wanted to weigh in, Dr. Jeffers, on just this whole relationship trust thing, because I have to just add one little thing. Again, in doing research for the show, this question of trust and mistrust seemed to be sort of embedded in all the research, all the studies that have been done about this persistent gap.
Yes, and I think that OBGYN in particular has been a historically problematic field in which Black women in particular feel like they have gotten the short end of the stick. And we know based off of all this data that it's kind of true for whatever reason or another. And so I feel like additionally, OBGYN is one of the only specialties where you develop longstanding relationships with your patients. If it's over a pregnancy, over the 9 months and delivery, in addition to the fact that these are events that women think about their entire life. And so there's a lot riding on that and whether or not it's going to be the way they envisioned. And I feel that from what I've seen thus far, some of the issue is that we're not taking the time out to really understand our patients and why they have such a distrust for the system. And I think that I feel like is my new goal, is to make sure that I can understand that and be able to kind of see them eye to eye to develop those relationships.
Have you seen the same kind of thing, Dr. Corbin?
Yeah, definitely. A little different slant here in the emergency department, but absolutely, it's rapport is everything. And I think that's what absolutely builds trust. I do think that, I mean, there have been some studies, and I think we're trying to move forward in a better way. But there are some studies that have shown that, Black patients, they get the least amount of time spent with them. And interestingly, that's in part from Black physicians to the patient and white physicians to the patient. And so trying to level those grounds is really important. But that also contributes to the mistrust in our patients.
In fact, you have looked at that in the emergency room, have you not, Dr. Johnson, about sort of how doctors within the ER look at patients and whether they're Black or whether they're white or patients of color?
So I do a lot of research looking at racial and ethnic disparities in pediatric emergency care and looking at what are some of the sources of those disparities. So we know that there's a, study after study after study that shows that in adult populations and pediatric populations, minorities tend to have poorer quality care. And I'm really looking at understanding what are some of the factors at the healthcare system level that are contributing to that, and what are some of the factors in that doctor-patient relationship contributing to that, and what are some of the factors at kind of the patient and family level. And a lot of that work right now is looking at bias and how bias contributes to disparities. So there's a, growing body of research that shows that healthcare providers similar to the general population, getting that MD doesn't mean that we're immune from having biases. So when you live and breathe and check social media and have different interactions with the world, everyone has some type of bias that they bring to the table. And the literature shows that healthcare providers have that bias too. And we're looking at some of that literature to do a better understanding about when we come to the door with these biases, how does that actually impact patient care? And there is a lot of research that shows that one of the biggest area that it impacts is communication. So doctors who have more bias have more kind of closed off communication styles with their patients. They use more verbally dominant words, less kind of social communications with their patients. And this is all unconscious. So it's not something that they're necessarily doing on a conscious level. But even when they're not aware of it, the patients are aware of it. So even if we're able to make the actual right treatment decisions for our patients because of these this kind of challenge with the communication, the patients are picking up on it. And then that's also going to impact, even if you prescribe the right prescription, are they going to use it when they leave the healthcare encounter based on this communication challenge?
And it's a more sort of aggressive communication or just not the kind of interaction that a patient would be looking for.
Exactly.
Go ahead. Yes.
Yeah, I completely agree. And sometimes I've noticed that we're not speaking in a language that the patient can understand. Mm-hmm. And then nothing is going to happen. Whatever kind of recommendations you gave, you are using language that is not in lay terms. You're not kind of explaining why whatever you're recommending is important. And like you said, it's using more dominant words. And I feel like the most important thing to do is for everyone to understand that they're an advocate for their own health, and that at least with my patients, I try to make it very clear from the jump that, we're a team. and we have the same goal, healthy mom, healthy baby, whatever it is. And I think starting off like that, that, you know, we're on the same, we have the same goals, makes things a lot easier or smoother for them to understand.
Do you think that explains when you look at outcomes, do you think that explains the fact that, for many African Americans, dying at younger ages when dealing with things like cancer or hypertension or heart disease, all the kind of chronic diseases, if there isn't that kind of communication, then that's going to affect care and that's going to affect outcomes.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I would actually go a step further and say that it black men across the country, we die the earliest. We have a lower life expectancy. And it is in part because of sometimes, you know, our black patients may not have the level of education of some of the other patients. And so you would think that providers would spend a little bit more time explaining and getting them to understand so that they too can be advocates of their healthcare. But without that information, without that communication, that's not going to happen.
But is that the implicit bias? Is that there's a sense of, I don't want to call it prejudice, but there's a barrier there. I'm looking at you, Dr. Johnson.
So I think that we need to acknowledge racism on multiple levels. So when it comes to what some of the sources of disparities are, we first need to acknowledge some of the institutionalized racism that exists, especially when it comes to some of those disparities in chronic illness and mortality and outcomes, recognizing that when you are born and when you enter into this country, you're not entering in on a level playing field. So some of the institutionalized racism that results in lots of differences between socioeconomic status and some of that residential segregation that impacts the safety of your neighborhoods, that impacts your access to even healthy breathing environments when you're going outside to play on the playground, that impacts your ability to access nutritious, healthy food and other social determinants around where you live, learn, work, and play. So for children, their access to high quality education systems that are going to help to improve their socioeconomic status. So these are all things that are definitely resulting in an uneven playing field, resulting in lots of disparities in chronic illnesses as well as in acute illnesses. And then we also do acknowledge that even within the healthcare system, there is definitely unconscious bias, and that unconscious bias on a part of healthcare mm-hmm. providers can have potential impacts on those relationships as well as treatment decisions with the patients.
And that's Dr. Tiffany Johnson, who joins us along with Dr. Shanae Jeffers and Dr. Ted Corbin. And you can join our conversation. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Covering a lot of territory on Radio Time today. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, especially if what we are talking about is something that connects in your life. We do want to hear from you. I want to hear from you, Dr. Jeffers, about the work that you do with teenage girls, with young women having to do with self-esteem, reproductive health, sex education. What's the sort of focus of what you do?
Okay, so Daughters of the Diaspora is an organization exactly like you described, and it's really geared toward adolescent women of color right now in the Philadelphia area who are interested in reproductive health, who are interested in kind of sexual health as well, and understanding how that is all related when it comes to your self-esteem, self-care, and setting goals for yourself. And I think that, Dr. Corbin, you touched on this, you know, from the perspective of black males, but if you don't know what you can do if you never see it growing up. And I think that what I have noticed is, one, there's a lot of girls who are interested in their bodies, and it has nothing to do with their desire to become sexual or anything that I think we have once, you know, stigmatized. And they just want to get a better understanding of how these things work. And even with my patients that I see in the hospital, it's shocking how many women kind of don't understand why they get a period or what that means. Yeah.
So they're not getting it in school. They're not getting it at home. They're not getting it anywhere.
Exactly.
Maybe on the internet, but I'm not sure that's where you want a young person to go to learn about sexuality.
Exactly. And I think, like, culturally, just, you know, as an urban black person, I think that, you know, you got reprimanded for asking these questions to your, you know, your mom, your aunt, because you were considered to be grown or something that was scary to them. And so a lot of the information that there's either no information passed down about how to use a tampon or, you know, how to actually put on a condom or what consent is and what it's not, these things kind of get hush-hush. And sometimes there's a lot of misinformation that gets passed down through generations. And so our goal is to kind of debunk those things, set up a safe space that's kind of casual, doesn't feel like it's, you know, a school setting necessarily, and it's taught by people who look like you. So you feel a little bit more open and understood. And our curriculum is really meant for, it uses language that we feel like young Black women will be able to understand. And I think it's been really successful so far. I also think that part of our goal is really as preventative medicine, that this is preventative care, giving these kids the opportunity to have the education to ask these questions. We even have diagrams that people can fill in, you know, how many holes are below the, you know, waist, because these are things that people don't know.
It's so important.
And ultimately, we think that just this knowledge, just this exposure to the healthcare system in this way will help these young women understand what questions they want to ask when they go to the doctor, and just to be more in tune with their bodies and themselves.
Well, I'm thinking of the work that you do. It's different but also similar, Dr. Corbin, in that you work with young men. I mean, many of them coming to the ER because they have been shot. But nonetheless, do you see some kind of parallels in terms of having, in a sense, no one explained to them about things that are so important related to their health care?
Absolutely. And I mean, right down to, and medicine is such that it's become really sophisticated, really advanced, and yet the communication piece is still somewhat lacking in instances where some of our young men, and we see women too that have been intentionally injured, unfortunately, but some of them, just because of whatever they're experiencing from being shot, stabbed, that trauma, and this could take shape in appearing numb and not responsive, and some of the care providers misinterpret that as them having no remorse. And then that kind of starts to tilt the relationship in some ways where, well, I'm not going to help you if you're not going to help me understand how I can help you. So it's that kind of spiral that occasionally happens. But I will say that we really work with these individuals to get them connected, get them better, to work to decrease some of their traumatic symptoms, and also get them work on some of their immediate needs, be it primary health care, which is a big deal because they fall out of care from being in pediatric care to going to adult care because there might be lack of employment and things of that nature, but very similar in terms of us trying to work with them to get them connected.
Let me read something. This was a report released just yesterday called Brotherly Love, Health of Black Men and Boys in Philadelphia. It comes from the mayor's office, and I'll just read the first paragraph here. Life expectancy is lowest among Black men, 69.1 years. This is in Philly, compared to other groups, more than 5 years less than other men, 10 years less than women. Poor life expectancy among Black men is largely driven by more premature death from homicides, early cardiovascular disease, drug overdoses, cancer, and infant deaths. I mean, I don't know if that shocks you. This is shocking. This is very worrisome.
Yeah, it's absolutely worrisome. And to Dr. Johnson's point, in terms of the institutionalized issues that are ever so present, because we know that unfortunately, Black people are less likely to get angioplasty when they're having heart issues. They're less likely to have hip replacements. So there's a myriad of a whole host of things where Black people aren't receiving when in fact they should.
Right. And maybe not even Dr. Johnson, even going to get the care they need when they have some of these serious diseases.
Potentially. So if there are some of those challenges with trust in a healthcare system, then that may lead to not accessing the healthcare system to receive medical care. But also when you kind of go through that list of some of the things that are contributing to the higher mortality rates and shortened lifespan in African Americans, recognizing that experiences of racism is a stressor. And there is data that shows that actually triggers different hormones in your body that actually increases your risk of chronic disease. So, for example, releases cortisol, which is a stress hormone. It sometimes affects your ability to be able to respond to illnesses. It affects your immune system. It affects your ability to control your blood sugar, which can lead to diabetes. And there's literature that shows that just experiencing stress from things like racism living in America can increase your risk of all of these things.
You want to speak to that?
Yeah, I mean, as
it's such an important point. I mean, it's both subtle and not subtle at the same time.
100%. I feel like, especially in OBGYN, when we're wondering why at, you know, the time of delivery, why do moms and babies have worse outcomes? And some of the data that I've been looking at with respect to this in particular is exactly that. It's women are responding to some of the stress that they feel in their pregnancy, feeling judged, feeling not listened to. And it's believed that kind of the epigenetics, the fancy word for all of that kind of environmental change, can affect outcomes. And it speaks to a little bit about why we don't see differences across increased socioeconomic status, increased educational status, which, you know, you'd assume that would help improve outcomes, but there's something deeper than just, you know, our characteristics that is working against us.
You want to speak to that, Dr. Parker?
Yeah, I mean, we have a presence both at Hahnemann University Hospital and St. Christopher's Hospital for Children, Healing Hurt People does. And we just looked at some data and we saw that 75% of the kids that have been intentionally injured walk in with PTSD. It's like 75%, which is sad. And that's not to say that they still were high in some of the other, you know, categories that qualify you as having post-traumatic stress. And so that alone, you know, this is a pediatric population that's exposed to chronic issues, chronic stress on a regular basis. So, you know, we have to help them.
And that's that link between mental health and physical health and, you know, the mind and the body. Let's take another short break and get back to our conversation. We've got a lot of people that want to join us as well. That's Dr. Ted Corbin, who joins us along with Dr. Shanae Jeffers and Dr. Tiffany Johnson. We are talking about some of the work that they are doing here in Philadelphia to address the implicit bias, perhaps even explicit bias when it comes to healthcare and some of the healthcare disparities when it comes to African-Americans and race in particular. 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Do stay with us. Much more to talk about after this short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Let me read a couple of comments and we'll get back to our conversation. Neil from Conshohocken says, do minorities use urgent care more than primary care physicians because of insurance disparity? How does that affect quality of care? Perhaps I can put that to you, Dr. Johnson. Have you looked at that, sort of how people use our very convoluted healthcare system?
So I think access to insurance is one issue, but we are fortunate enough that a lot of children do qualify for CHIP and public health insurance programs that do provide them with access to primary care. But that is still certainly an issue in helping to make sure that we get our pediatric population insured so they can get access to care. But I think in addition to insurance issues, there's also just issues of hours. So availability of after hours clinics. So if you are either a single parent or even a two parent household, but both parents are working, access to services after hours so that when you get off of work, you can actually take your child to a visit, a sick visit at your pediatric office is another issue. And I think that's an issue here in Philadelphia, but I've also practiced in lots of other places in Pittsburgh and in DC. And so how do we provide kind of more after hours access to those families that are working so that they don't have to access the emergency department in order to receive their
care?
Or take
a day off from work where they might not get paid.
Exactly.
An email from Sean, are there training programs for doctors on how to communicate effectively when there are racial boundaries present? And perhaps I can toss that to you, Dr. Jeffers, about if there are something all three of you have mentioned, but just this important role of communication and making sure you get it right.
Yeah, so I think the culture of medicine or medical education has changed such that that has become a new goal. So in medical school, that, you know, cultural competency and having kind of workshops to be able to elicit one's own personal biases and then also how to navigate when your patient may have biases or when you experience that with your colleagues. So I think that the effort is definitely there. Definitely as a resident, you know, in terms of, you know, when we come in as an intern, we have these same kind of discussions and conversations, but in a very diverse, you know, place like this, it's mm-hmm. it's difficult to really touch on everything.
And doctors, I mean, you're so busy. I mean, it certainly looks that way trying to, if you're in the ER or if you're mm-hmm. delivering babies.
And burnout is real.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I just want to add that at Dr. the Children's Johnson. Hospital of Philadelphia, we recognize that training is not a one and done. So you can't expect to sit in a 2-hour cultural competency training session and be prepared to have effective cross-cultural communication. So one of the things that we've implemented in the residency program is a bias and disparities curriculum where we have multiple touch points for the residents. So it starts off in intern orientation where they have an inclusion and exclusion circle. We do several noon conferences throughout the year where we give them presentations on disparities in pediatric healthcare, unconscious bias. I actually gave a talk on microaggressions a couple of weeks ago. And then they also have a professionalism series, which is just a general series on how you do communicate with your patients as well as communicating with your colleagues. And recently we've dedicated half of those sessions to focusing on these issues around bias and disparities so that it's continued dialogues and not just a one and done.
You told me during the break, Dr. Corbin, that you want to talk about minority tax, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
What is that?
So it's really we as academic black academic clinicians are committed to educating, you know, the future doctors. And so because there's such a dearth of black physicians in academic medicine, we see some of the few in medical school that are in need of mentorship, of guidance, of simple questions being answered that they don't necessarily feel comfortable asking a white academic physician, or just not able to find anyone. Mm-hmm. And so in those instances, we feel absolutely committed and absolutely will meet with that medical student. Yet, and that in of itself is a lot to do in addition to the other things that we do. And sometimes the institution doesn't recognize that. And so therefore we are seen as we're supposed to do this. And we absolutely are going to do it.
I get it.
But it also should be recognized that this is part of the work that we've committed to do, is to help educate our young medical students, while also being cognizant of black medical students and some of their needs as well.
I think the challenge of the minority tax, so in addition to the mentorship, there's also sometimes you're asked to serve as the diversity representative on many committees. Exactly. And when you're in an academic environment, the way kind of like you get promoted and succeed in your job, you don't get a lot of credit for that service. And so that service takes away from you doing those things that you actually are required for your job for promotion, which may be, you know, writing papers, writing grants, and getting published. So one of the things I think that I work on with my mentoring team is these are the things that I'm passionate about. So how do I scholarize my passion, right? So right. I'm really committed promoting minority medical students and trainees and meeting with them and to doing this service work. But how do I do it in a way where I can still get credit at my institution? Because the best way for me to help students is by being successful and getting promoted. I'm trying to become full professor like you, Dr. Corbin. how can you do these things in a way where you kind of can still generate currency in your institution to get promoted? But I think that's also a call to institutions nationally.
Absolutely.
How can we reimagine kind of this tenure and promotion system to give credit for all of this work, that's whether it's community engaged work or whether it's some of this service work related to diversity.
Let me read an email from Joe. He says, I and one of my Dominican students are both type 1 diabetics. I've always had a problem with endocrinologists that I have had and has led to not receiving good guidance for diabetes management. On the flip side, two of my bosses have spouses who are type 1 diabetics, and both spouses have good endocrinologists that have also made sure that the latest technology is available to better manage their diabetes. I do not believe this has happened by chance. I mean, in certain ways, I think that's what we have been talking about, Dr. Jeffers.
Yeah. Actually, the other day, I had a woman come in, you know, in labor, and she was very uncomfortable, but was adamant that she didn't want an epidural, which is absolutely fine. But we were kind of like caught in this in between. It's like, okay, well, you want pain management. This is going to be the best method. But she and her two support people were like, no, we can't do this. Everyone we know who's had an epidural has been, you know, has had negative effects afterward. And she started to say something along the lines of, like, there was just something palpable, like, she didn't want to say, but I felt like what she was going to say is, like, you guys don't know how to care for us, and you guys are going to mess this up. And that, you know, really spoke to me, because as the only, you know, Black provider in the room, I just had to, you know, look at this woman and say, I hear you, and just take it from there. And she had a successful delivery, but I was very aware of the fact that this woman didn't even want to come here for us to do anything to her or for her, and that even having trusting us to have a safe delivery was a lot for her. And that whatever experience that she'd had thinking that people got, you know, worse care and worse outcomes, it was affecting her present situation.
Sure.
And so, you know, I believe it.
Yeah. And but it sounds like things went well. So maybe, you know, maybe that success will change something the next time. And I'm thinking the ER is just, you know, it's, I mean, certainly from what I see on TV, I mean, it looks like just pandemonium. Is it?
Certainly feels like that. I was working last night and it was a very, very busy night. And that is one of the challenges in the ER, and compared to some of the other specialties, you don't necessarily have that opportunity to kind of establish that doctor-patient relationship. So it's a challenge that we have to face, where how do you build that rapport with those families in a very little amount of time so that you can get on the same page and identify what their questions and what their concerns are, which may not necessarily link up with the chief complaint for what they signed in for, and address what their concerns are, and establish that rapport and that relationship.
This is a long email. I'll try to make it through some of it anyway. I'm a nurse practitioner. This is from Monica. When I sent my resume to a clinic in Boston that serves a Haitian Caribbean West African community, I got a call from the medical director who asked if I was okay working with a Black patient population. He said, all of our patients are Black, head to toe Black. I need to ask you this because we have had a revolving door of providers who say they are comfortable. They're not comfortable working with minority populations, and then goes on, and they don't stay. I mean, we touched on this, I'm not sure what to call it, this tension, this uncomfortableness, this racial barrier that does exist. Anything you want to say in response to that, Dr. Gordon?
Yeah, it's sad that this is still happening. And a colleague of mine, Dr. Ken Hardy, and also Dr. Howard Stevenson, really have been helping us understand, helping my team understand these issues of racial trauma and also racial literacy. And there's this thing that I found so profound, is that race is in some instances uncomfortable to talk about. Not necessarily uncomfortable between people of color, but then when we're engaged in that conversation with a white person, it is uncomfortable. And what has a tendency to happen is that Black people, and it's because of the socialization of things, Black people feel concerned about white people. And so we diffuse the conversation in some instances.
Feeling judged, or?
It would be Black people, or feeling that we want to somehow make sure that the white person doesn't feel uncomfortable.
Oh, because and somehow that becomes a burden. And then you have to put out that fire.
Exactly. And so, but we've been, I'm working more towards it just to really engage the person, and just to have a conversation and make it intimate. And it's not a confrontation. It's really a conversation to help someone, and to help me understand and figure out how we can work with this issue of race.
And as the white person sitting here, I mean, I have to say,
are we making you uncomfortable?
No, and I appreciate you asking me that. No, I was thinking, I think for a lot of white people, they want the same thing. They also don't want to make the Black person that they're talking to feel uncomfortable, but that creates a barrier, doesn't it, Dr. Johnson?
Absolutely. And I think that one of the biggest things is, like, how do we just get to know each other, right? So when we think about, so a lot of my work focuses on implicit bias, and we think about, like, what are some of the effective strategies aimed at reducing some of that implicit or unconscious bias? One of those strategies is, how do you increase your opportunities for cross-cultural contact? So if as a healthcare provider, the only Black people who you interact with are your patients in the emergency department, or the only Black people that you see are the representations of Blacks in the media, on Twitter or on the news, or or in on television shows, then you're going to have these stereotypes that are going to continue to be activated. But if you can increase your opportunity for, and I think in general, people have a tendency to towards homophily, right? You just want to be around people who look like you and who think like you. It makes those conversations easier. But if you increase your opportunity to interact with people from different backgrounds than you and to learn from different cultures, then you're more likely to be able to deactivate some of those stereotypes, some of those group-based stereotypes when you can interact with different groups and then really approach someone as an individual and not just that cultural box that they sit in. So I think it's important for all of us as, you know, healthcare providers, for the general community and our patients, how do we just work on having more dialogue so that we can really find those connections to what makes us similar and not just what makes us different. And I think that'll make things better.
Well, and being a healthcare provider, I mean, it is, Dr. Jeffers, I mean, that is such an intimate relationship that you have. It's different from being someone's lawyer or someone's teacher or someone's dry cleaner. I mean, you really, you know us in a way that, that no one does. Yeah. Except maybe an intimate partner.
Yeah. And it's a true privilege. And I think it really needs to be treated as such. I can't emphasize enough when things are starting to go not as planned in like the labor course, you know, just to say to the patient, like, I acknowledge that this is something that you have been thinking about, you've been planning, envisioning forever, and it's getting scary. There's a lot of people in the room. There are terms you're not familiar with, but, you know, we're here with you and we're here to support you. It's a team effort. But yeah, it's I really think we really need to appreciate it as the privilege that it is.
Well, we've been diagnosing a lot of problems on the air, and we have a couple of minutes before we have to say goodbye to you, Dr. Corbin, then. Are we making progress when it comes to dealing with these disparity with bias, whether in the doctor's office or in the ER, you know, anywhere in a hospital setting?
I'm always hopeful, and we are. But we also have to recognize that it's going to take a long time. I mean, to where we are now, we would think that we would have achieved some harmony of such. But we have absolutely have not, given the statistics that we were talking about here. But I do think it is important for us to really have that dialogue and open those communications to talk about these issues of race, to name them and not talk around them.
Yeah. How about for you, Dr. Johnson?
I'm certainly hopeful when I look at the next generation, and I consider myself a young and fabulous doctor.
You are.
Particularly when I look at the trainees, so the medical students and the resident and fellowship trainees who are coming in the pipeline, it's really a very social justice oriented generation that really excites me. So I'm so glad to be here sitting next to Dr. Jeffers, who's doing the great work that she's doing, and I'm hopeful that we'll be able to continue to work on changing the culture. So I'm excited about this new generation that is in the pipeline that will hopefully continue to change the face of medicine.
Do you feel you're part of that, Dr. Jeffers?
I really do. You know, when I am in the clinic and I have a 69-year-old patient here for her annual, and then I have an 18-year-old patient, and they both say to me, wow, you're my first Black doctor. I'm so excited. I'm so happy. That's all I need.
That's a good day for you.
Yeah, it really is.
Well, we're going to end on that note. My thanks to all three of you for joining us. I know how busy you are joining us today in Radio Times. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having us.
You're very welcome. And let me just tell you who you were listening to, Dr. Tiffany Johnson, faculty member at Policy Lab at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. She's also an assistant professor of pediatrics in the Division of Emergency Medicine at CHOP and a member of CHOP's Center for Perinatal and Pediatric Health Disparities Research. Dr. Shanae Jeffers, obstetrics and gynecology resident at Thomas Jefferson University Hospital and site director of Daughters of the Diaspora, and Dr. Ted Corbin, professor in the Department of Emergency Medicine at Drexel University College of Medicine, and he's the medical director of Healing Hurt People. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show. Find us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. And we did take pictures of our guests, which we will post on our Facebook page. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, with help from Elle Banks, Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen produce Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.